But what I wanted to do tonight is I thought I would show you some slides and introduce this hermit tradition that is so different from our hermit tradition. Our hermits generally want to build bombs, or at least they want to be left alone. And in China, the hermit tradition is a very important part of society. It's part of society, and it's always been one of the most respected traditions. In ancient China, emperors would call these hermits down from the mountains to become ministers, because they figured they weren't corrupt. And the thing about the Chinese hermit tradition, it exists in all spiritual paths. The Confucians, the Taoists, the Buddhists, they all have this, share this hermit tradition. And I tell people it's just like our graduate school for the spiritual realm. It's not for undergraduates, it's for graduates. If you follow a spiritual path in China, Confucian, Taoist, or Buddhist, and you study with a master, you get to a certain point, some people are called to get a graduate degree. And in China, if you are so called, you go to a mountain. And if it's like, I'm a Buddhist, so my familiarity is more in Buddhist, but every monastery in China or nunnery has a relationship with a specific mountain where they've been sending their graduate students for the last 1,000 years. And it might be right behind the monastery, it might be 500 miles away. And so the master will take the student to that mountain and help carry up a few bags of food and then say, you're on your own. And very often there'll be these huts on the mountains that are empty, that have been built and just abandoned. And they're just, people move in, people move out. But anyway, I'll show you some slides and then we'll talk about this some more. So anyway, I always like to start with a couple of slides I drew here, just to let you know how China looks and how China was formed when the Indian plate went under the Eurasian plate, lifted up all of Central Asia, and what this did is it cut off the monsoons. So Central Asia became a really arid place, and of course it lifted up the land masses here, and so all the rivers went downhill. And the next slide, so this is what happened after that took place. You get all these great river systems coming out of the Himalayas or the Tibetan Plateau, all going out to the sea. The Yellow River, this is the river along which Chinese civilization developed from Paleolithic times until about 1000 AD. And then the center of Chinese civilization switched to the Yangtze down here, and it's been centered around the Yangtze pretty much since then. It's so arid up in here. This is the Taklamakan Desert, the world's second largest desert. That's the Tongariro Desert, the world's third largest desert. This is, again, the Yellow River. And that's the river we're going to spend most of our time on in these slides. And this is the West River right down here, and then there's the Mekong there. In the next slide, this is the Yellow River coming down here and going out to the sea, but you can see this is the shoreline, and this is the area that Chinese civilization developed. And you can see in 5500 BC, all of North China was an ocean. Where Chinese civilization developed was this is sort of the breadbasket that founded, provided the grain surpluses that allowed the Chinese to develop their civilization. And you can see it was all mud. But because it was all mud and it got these regular floods from the Yellow River, it was very, very easy to farm. You didn't need metal technology. You could dig a canal with a stick, and water came down every summer. And anyway, right where this arrow is, so this was all susceptible to floods. Big mountain range right in here, the Taihang Mountains. But this is sort of a highland right in here. And this is where Chinese civilization developed its cities. So where this arrow is in the next slide, we get the Shang Dynasty capital and the Xia and the Zhou. This is the first dynasty. You can see all these dynasties are all around the Yellow River. Okay, and where that little dot is in the next slide. This is the grave of Confucius, who died here around 450 BC. And the next slide. This is China's most sacred mountain called Taishan. These halls are actually 1,000 years old. They have not been redone. They have not been rebuilt. Because it was the most sacred mountain, the emperors would come here to honor the mountain. And no emperor could become an emperor without coming to the mountain to pay their respects. So mountains have always had this sacred, they're sort of like, viewed like acupuncture points. They're power spots. And this is the mountain where the Chinese believe your spirit goes for reassignment to the afterlife. So all Chinese try to come here during their life to pay their respects to this mountain. Okay, in the next slide, this is the beginning of the trail. It says the number one mountain here, and here it says Confucius climbed here. Because this is only about 30 miles from Confucius' grave and where he grew up. So Confucius used to come to this mountain also to meditate, to be alone. And the next slide, you see the trail. Of course, this trail has been built by emperors and kings and local magistrates and people, and it takes about 5 hours to walk up the trail if you're in good health. It can take a couple days. This fellow's probably in his second day. But here's a guy with about 40 bottles of beer on his shoulders. So there's refreshments along the way, too. And the next slide, and you finally get to the top, there's a Taoist temple. Because all these sacred mountains in China are basically Taoist mountains. And these men are examining a stele that records the restoration of this place by an emperor a couple hundred years ago. And the resident spirit of this mountain is a goddess named Bi Xia Yuanjun, the goddess of the azure-colored clouds. And so he's about to go inside and conduct a ceremony in here to the goddess. So anyway, next slide. So this is Taishan, that sacred mountain. Qifu is Confucius' hometown. This is Mencius' hometown. The most famous Confucian after Confucius is Mencius. And the man who made Confucianism the state religion was a man named Sun Tzu, and his grave is right down here. So these were all great Confucians, and all the Taoists are over here. This is Zhuang Tzu's home, is up here in Zhaoxian. Right here where this arrow is in the next slide is the old home of Lao Tzu. This is Lao Tzu, the author of the Tao Te Ching's old home. These village women have come here to pray, perhaps for a son or a grandson, because Lao Tzu is supposed to bestow male offspring to families. This is a dirt village, though. When I came here back in, what was it? Was this 1991. Now they bulldozed it, and it's a huge tourist complex now. The next slide. This is Lao Tzu's old observatory. And of course, a Taoist priest is standing next to me right there. Because the Taoists, of course, are interested in the movements of the Tao and in establishing the harmony of the Tao within the body. All of Chinese medicine is a development of that study of what goes on inside the body. But the Taoists believe that our bodies are simply a microcosm of the greater cosmos. So it's difficult to know what's going on in the body, and you can get a better idea just by watching the stars. And so all these early Taoists had observatories. And not just the stars, also clouds. The shapes of clouds and the colors of clouds were very important. Anyway, this is just an old observatory. Dates back to, the original observatory was about 500 BC. That was when Lao Tzu lived here. It's been rebuilt quite a few times. Now, moving on. And so when Lao Tzu left civilization to go into the mountains himself, he went through this Hangu Pass. This is along the Yellow River, and here it goes up into Inner Mongolia. Anyway, where this arrow is the Hangu Pass. And the next slide, This is the most strategic place in all of China. Even during the Second World War, the Japanese could not break through this pass. They had to fly around it. This is where Lao Tzu came, and the warden of the pass recognized him as a sage and asked him to write down his teachings, which became the book we call the Tao Te Ching. And you can see how narrow it is here. Just one or two soldiers could defend this pass, because it goes for 17 kilometers like this. This is all that loess, that refined soil that blows down from Inner Mongolia, can't get past the mountains, so it just settles right there between the mountains on the one side and the Yellow River on the other. So this is the way you have to go if you're going to go west. And the next slide, this is the earliest complete copy of the Tao Te Ching. It dates back to 200 BC. We have about 20 years ago, they found an earlier copy, partial copy, dating back around 300 BC. So this is, again, the Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. The next slide. Lao Tzu continued on after he wrote the Tao Te Ching, supposedly, to this mountain, which is another sacred mountain to the Tao. It's called Huashan. Next slide. This is an engraving of the mountain. Huashan means flower mountain, so you can see it's like a flower coming out of a foliage of stone here. And the next slide, this is going up the trail that goes up the mountain. This is these caves here are caves used by hermits. This is a very famous hermit, a woman who lived in the Han Dynasty. This is her name, the Jade Maiden of the Bright Star. That was her cave where she meditated. This is a cave right here, and this is a fancy one. It's got a skylight, and you can see post holes that would have held eaves that would have kept out the rain and the wind a little bit. So Taoists go to a lot of trouble to be alone when they go to a mountain, because Taoist meditations are much more intricate and involved than Buddhist meditations. They really like to be alone. Next slide. This girl is trying to find this Taoist hermit. It's 3,000 feet straight down. And there's two 2x4s, and she's got loafers on, and she's holding onto an iron chain. And the hermit, there's a cave right around this ridge right around here that she's trying to go to. And there's a little Taoist shrine there, and I asked the Taoist, so do people fall? He said, oh, about once a month. And then I asked the guy, well, is the hermit there? And he said, no. So I didn't go out there. This picture. So in the next slide, this is the man she was looking for. He had gone down the mountain. His rheumatism, he had been on the mountain for 50 years, and he was 85 when I took this picture. And so this is a typical Taoist garb. He has a hat with a hole in the middle where his hair comes out, because you wear your hair, you never cut your hair if you're a Taoist. And usually they wear black robes, but also blue. And the next slide. Oh, well, that one didn't work out so well. Next slide. So anyway, that's where Lao Tzu ended up. He disappeared when he got to the Huashan, and nobody knows where he ends up after that. And then Buddhism shows up around the time of Christ. It arrives on the Silk Road through these series of oases and ends up in the capital of Luoyang. The next slide, I think I have a slide. Yeah, this is the first Buddhist temple in China, was in Luoyang. It's called White Horse Temple because the first monks arrived with horses that were white in color, and they were laden with these Buddhist sutras. That temple is still there in Luoyang. Also, next slide. Luoyang is famous for its Buddhist carvings, called the Longmen Caves. And the next slide. And also, just outside of Luoyang is Songshan, another sacred Taoist mountain. But this is a Buddhist pagoda built around 500 AD. And about the time that this was built, up on the mountain here, in the next slide, you can see this is a cave. on the same mountain called Songshan, and this is Bodhidharma's cave. The man who brought Zen to China meditated in this cave for 9 years, supposedly. And so it says Damodong, Bodhidharma's cave. And there's an inscription left by an emperor who came to pay his respects. And so this is where Zen first showed up in China. Again, around 500 AD. The next slide. Now that I've sort of wanted to introduce these three spiritual traditions, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, and show you how they're all connected to the mountains. Eventually, you go up to the mountains if you're going to practice these traditions. And so if you go down to this is the Yangtze River, that's Shanghai. And right about here, there's a mountain called Zhouhuashan. It's probably the most famous and sacred Buddhist mountain. In the next slide, this is the mountain where the Kshitagarbha incarnation is resident. Kshitagarbha is the bodhisattva who has vowed to save all the beings in hell. So this is the old trail going up the mountain. Zhouhuashan means nine flower mountain, so it has nine peaks. And the next slide, this is the trail. Again, that stone steps that many people have paid to have made over the centuries. And you notice that there are lots of locks. There's usually an iron chain along the side of the trail, and it's covered with locks. That's because the Chinese will make a pilgrimage to these sacred sites with the idea of earning merit that they then transfer to somebody, usually to a relative of a parent that is sick. And so they will make a vow. Usually it's to be a vegetarian twice a month. On the new moon and the full moon, they will not eat any meat. That's a typical vow that Chinese pilgrims will make. And they will put a lock here and they'll say, this lock will rust away before I break my vow. Or lovers will often leave locks, too. That's why the locks. Anyway, up the mountain we go. Next slide. This is the pilgrimage center and the people selling incense. And in this shrine hall here is kept the body of this Korean monk who is recognized in the Tang Dynasty as the incarnation of Kshitagarbha, Ditsang Bodhisattva, the bodhisattva who saves everyone in hell. They take out his body, I understand, once a year and give it a sponge bath in private and then put it back in the jar, a very, very large jar. And so this is the pilgrimage center up on Zhouhuashan. It's in the mountains, but if you just go right over this ridge right here, you get into the deep mountains in China. You think there's, with 1.5 billion people, there's no solitude in China, but you're quite wrong. Next slide. You can see, this is just right over the ridge from that mountain. There's lots of hermits living in here. Next slide. This is one of my favorite hermits. I've known her for about 25 years. Everybody, even though the locals call her the Tiger Lady, because this is called her hut's right next to a cave called Tiger Cave. And she has shown me tiger footprints in her garden on several occasions. She died 2 years ago, so she's not there anymore. But anyway, that's a typical hermit hut. And the next slide, there she is coming out of the cave. Next slide. And now we're going to go back to the north, to Xi'an, the ancient capital of Chang'an. And there's this mountain range called the Zhong'an Mountain south of here. The next slide, this is Xi'an today. That's the looking down on top of the city wall. There's a marathon around the wall every year where people run around the city. But this wall is only 600 years old from the Ming Dynasty. But this used to be the capital of many dynasties. And so there are a lot of monasteries in the area. Lots of monks, nuns lived in this area. And the next slide. Looking south of Xi'an, this is what you see. These are the Zhongnan Mountains. And this is that Los that blows down from Inner Mongolia, can't get past the mountains, so it settles there. And it's the deepest soil in the world as a result. And on this escarpment has been found human skulls and jawbones dating 1.3 million years. But people have been living here a long time. Anyway, we're going to go back into the mountains now. In the next slide, I flew out of Xi'an one day and took a picture of the Zhongnan Mountains as we were flying over it. This is also a picture of about 500 hermits. Find the hermits. This is what the hermits themselves estimate live, how many hermits live in this watershed. In the next slide. So when I go to China and I want to meet some hermits for some purpose, I just take a vehicle of some kind to the as far as the road goes to the last farming village, and then you just walk into the mountains. And so hermits are like us, villagers are like us. They will commute to work, and farmers will commute about an hour to a field. So if you're going to go find some hermits, you got to find the village and then walk at least an hour. And so that's what I do. I just go up a trail. Next slide. Because it's China, you always meet somebody on the trail. And so these three men have been gathering walnuts. And in fact, they've been gathering walnuts from a hermit nun. That's what the poles are for, the big baskets. And so whenever you're in China and you're in the mountains, you just ask them, is anybody cultivating the Tao on this mountain? And they know exactly what you're talking about. And they'll either take you there or they'll draw you a little map in the mud about which trail to take. Because the trails are really hard to find sometimes. The next slide. So now there's a hermit coming down the mountain right there. There's the trail. You can see it's not very clear. It doesn't get much traffic. And the next slide, he stops long enough that he's going. His bag is empty. He's going down to the village because he doesn't have any food. And he's pointing to his hut and telling me just to go up there and wait for him. He'd come back in a couple hours and I could spend the night. The next slide, that's his hut. He'd been there about 10 years. It's a little windy up there. Next slide. This is probably the most famous hut in China. It belonged to a Zen master named Empty Cloud. And when I took this picture, nobody was living there, but I went back a few years later and it's all been fixed up now. These huts, again, sometimes they're empty, and sometimes people move in. And the next slide, here in hermit real estate, this is called a fixer-upper. You could move in if you want, but it's going to be a little work for that one. But they you know, like us, they try to locate near a water source, and where they can get some firewood. In the mountains, but again, beyond where farmers will commute. And of course, they have to grow some of their own food, not all of it, but some of it. So you need some arable little patches here and there. And they collect a lot of wild plants. Next slide. Now this is probably the best hut I've ever seen. And the reason is this hermit, he was new, a young guy. He had graduated from Beijing University Chinese Literature Department. So he was a member of the intelligentsia. Then he became a young monk, and he had this hut built. It's all mud walls. He's going to have glass windows, a tiled roof. The whole thing cost a little over $100. It took six farmers 8 days to build. And right now he's firing it. Once the hut is built, see, it's built out of this loess, this fine soil, that once you put it in the form, the brick is done. And then you just build on top of it wet. And you build all the walls wet. And then you build a fire in for a couple of days. You fire the hut. You turn the hut into a teapot, basically. And then maybe put a slip of mud or something on the outside that you renew once a year, every so often. So this is, this is like the Hilton of huts right here. You usually don't see them that nice. Next slide. They all have one thing all huts have in common is they have this oven bed called a kham. See, there's a hole right there. This is all bricks, then with a mat on top. And so you build a fire in here, and there's a flue on the side where the smoke can go out. And then you heat the surface. So you don't try to heat air. You just heat a single surface, and then you do everything on your kam. You sleep on it, you eat on it, you drink tea on it, you meditate on it, you entertain visitors on it. Everything takes place on your kam. So you do need some firewood. That's what makes the hermit life possible. And of course, one of the problems all hermits have is the potential for arthritis if you don't do a good job of keeping your joints warm. The next slide. Here's a hermit nun, and you can see she doesn't have a tiled roof. And she was basically in tears when I interviewed her because she was having such a hard life. The villagers, she'd only been there for one winter, and the villagers weren't sure that she was serious. And I went back a couple years later, and she had a tiled roof, she had glass in her windows, she even had a disciple, and she was smiling. You know, the villagers had realized she was serious. So these hermits rely, to some extent, on the support of local villagers. And if the villagers don't take care of you, you're going to be short a little bit, usually during the winter. Anyway, this is a nun. Next slide. She's smiling. You can see she's got a tiled roof up here. And look, that's an apple tree. And that there's her young disciple. Now, last time I saw her alive, she'd been a hermit nun, for 35 years she had lived in that hut. And the last time I saw her alive, there were 6 Communist Party officials inside her hut. They had all heard about her and wanted to know what they could do to help her. These hermits are probably the most respected people in China because they're not corrupt. Everybody knows they're on a path that they chose and that them being there is doing everybody a lot of good. Now, this young girl was a college student. She was 17 years old, and she went hiking up on this mountain with her friends one day and met this nun. Was so impressed with her, she told her friends to go back down the mountain without her. And she has stayed there ever since. And she's now, this nun died about 8 years ago. And she is now the most famous master on the mountain. People come from all over to study with her. Anyway, this is a really nice hut. I love her hut. It's got 2 rooms in it, and very nice. Anyway, next slide. Now this is a South China hut, very different. They have rice down here. And this is a different hermit career. Usually you become a hermit early on in your career, when you're usually, after you've been in a monastery 4 or 5 years, then you become a hermit if you feel so called. Sometimes it's like this fellow, he was a famous abbot. And then after he was done being an abbot, then he became a hermit toward the end of his career. But here you can see he gets by with thatch because it's a much warmer climate. And he didn't even have a kong inside. He just had a regular a bamboo bed. Next slide. And hermits often take advantages of caves to live inside because they can just build some walls. They don't have to build a roof. And so this is the most famous cave hermit in China. This is the cave where Cold Mountain lived. The poet known as Han Shan, to whom Jack Kerouac dedicated Dharma Bums. This is Cold Mountain's old home. In the next slide, you get another view. You see how you just have walls. This is, of course, a modern, it's made with bricks, regular bricks. Cold Mountain, no doubt, didn't have bricks. And if you look out, this is looking out of the cave. Some pilgrims have built a small shrine there to Cold Mountain and his 2 friends. And that's Cold Mountain. The next slide, and the last slide, this is a slide of the incarnation of Stonehouse's hut. Stonehouse was this really great Buddhist poet who was a hermit. Spent over 30 years as a hermit on this one mountain. And when he moved, somebody else moved into his hut and became a small temple. And when I took this photo in 1991, the farmer was living in it, and he said that the Red Guards chased out the last monks. And now it's been rebuilt into a Buddhist temple. There's now a... And you can see it has great tea. These are tea bushes here. And this is all bamboo. Anyway, that's the end of my hermit slides. So we can turn off the thing over there and maybe turn on some lights. And what I'll do is I thought I would read a few of these poems that these two poets who are hermits wrote. Because most hermits don't write poetry. They meditate a lot. And of course, they to stay alive, you're always, from the time the sun comes up to the time the sun goes down, you're usually not meditating. Usually during daylight hours, you're out dealing with your water supply, wood supply, and food supply. But you meditate at night or in the morning. So hermits generally need four things. They need some kind of staple. You know, rice in the south, wheat flour in the north. They need salt so they can preserve vegetables and stuff over the winter. And they need cooking oil. Because all of these things they can't produce on the kind of land they have. And then they need some kerosene if they're going to read at night or early in the morning. So those are the four things they can't supply by themselves. And that's why they need a little help from the outside. Usually a friend will stop by, their old master, a fellow colleague, a monk or nun from their old temple, or a pilgrim like myself. And the villagers try to help them out. They don't always make it. That is, I'll be in the mountains in China and I'll be talking to a hermit and I'll say, there's a new hut up there, isn't there? And they'll often say, yeah, but that guy's not going to last one winter. Because that's sort of the bar, getting past that first winter. And a lot of people like the idea of the solitude of the hermit's life, but it's really hard. So it's not for everybody.